This is Steve Carroll, and you're listening to the EM Basic Podcast. Today, we're going to talk about altered mental status. This is a very broad topic, but we'll boil it down to the important things that you need to know about how to work up patients with this chief complaint. The differential for altered mental status is a long one and encompasses just about every organ system. What we'll do today is to go over the broad categories of altered mental status and how to work them up. As always, this podcast doesn't represent the views or opinions of the Department of Defense, the U.S. Army, or the Shawshank EM Residency. So let's get started where we always start, with the vitals. Obviously, each vital sign is important, but temperature is the most important vital sign in patients with altered mental status. A patient with altered mental status and fever puts us down a certain route right off the bat, so it's important that we recognize fever or even hypothermia in these patients. So when you're taking the patient's history, you have to find out exactly what is meant by altered mental status. To some people, this may mean that the patient is lethargic. To others, it may mean that the patient is acting bizarrely or not acting like themselves. You need to get as much information from the patient's family members as you can. Often we deal with patients from nursing homes who are sent in with altered mental status, but little other information is provided. We need to find out exactly what the nursing home means by altered mental status. I admit, it's extremely frustrating when the transfer paperwork doesn't say exactly why they think the patient is altered. You'll sometimes need to call the nurse at the nursing home and find out what is different about the patient. You can't start an effective workup without knowing where to begin, so you have to know what someone means by not acting right. Sometimes the EMS crew will know what the patient's baseline mental status is, so ask them if they're available. When you're taking a history, ask about any recent trauma or recent illnesses. Ask if there is any history of fever. You also want to get a sense of when exactly the change in mental status started. If the patient is acting really bizarrely, don't just chalk this up to them being a psych patient. Find out if they've ever acted this way before and if they're taking any psychiatric medications. A 30-year-old with a history of psychiatric illness who is acting bizarrely because he is having flight of ideas is a much different patient than a 50-year-old who is acting normally and then all of a sudden is acting strangely. On the flip side, psych patients can have organic disease too, so make sure to do your due diligence on each patient and not just attribute their behavior to their psychiatric diagnosis. Next, make sure that the patient hasn't taken anything. Account for any medications the patient may have had prescribed to them or that may be in the house. Also ask the patient whether they've taken any illegal drugs or ingested any alcohol. I'm not going to go through every medication that causes altered mental status here, but just know that it's an important part of the history. It's also important to actually talk to the patient. You'll want to ask them whether they know why they're at the hospital. You should also ask the basic orientation questions of their name, where they are right now, what day of the week it is, and you can also ask who the president is. Try to correlate the events leading up to them being in the hospital. If you have family members around, see how accurate the patient is in remembering recent events. Finally, get a good medical history. You'll want to pay special attention to a history of diabetes or any neurological diseases. Before we go into the exam of the patient, there's one thing that I need to hammer home. Any patient who is altered is hypoglycemic until proven otherwise. Let me say that again. Any patient who is altered is hypoglycemic until proven otherwise. This needs to be accomplished quickly because not catching it can really harm the patient, and it is one of the easiest conditions to take off the table. The more sick and altered the patient is, the more important checking a D-stick becomes. In fact, I think we need to change the ABC mnemonic to ABCD so that we don't forget to add a D-stick on any sick patient. So while you're getting the history or exam, get someone to check a D-stick on the patient and make sure that they aren't hypoglycemic. I have heard stories from more than one person who had a patient who was about to have tPA pushed for their stroke when the chemistry panel came back with a glucose of 10. As a little tangent, hypoglycemic patients can look exactly like a stroke with motor weakness, slurred speech, and the whole nine yards. The theory is that they have had a previous stroke in that area, and when they get hypoglycemic, that part of their brain is the most sensitive to the lack of glucose, and they have what looks like a stroke syndrome. So bottom line, get the D-stick, and if it's low, treat with an amp of D50 IV. Now let's talk about the exam. I think the most important part of any patient with altered mental status is the neuro exam. I detailed how to do a complete neuro exam during the headache podcast, so you can refer back to that podcast if you want the details on how to do a good neuro exam. If you really want to boil down the neuro exam down to its most important parts, I like the Cincinnati Pre-Hospital Stroke Scale. This is an easy and quick exam that takes less than a minute, but can give you a lot of information on the patient's neuro status. From there, you can do a full NIH stroke scale if you think that this is an acute stroke, but these three things will help you get going down the right path without wasting a lot of time. Plus, all three components are part of the NIH stroke scale anyway. So for the Cincinnati Pre-Hospital Stroke Scale, all you have to look for is asymmetry in the face, asymmetry in the arms, or abnormal speech. If any one of these are positive, you need to be concerned for a stroke. First, check for facial droop by having the patient smile and note any asymmetry. Next, have the patient put both arms level with their shoulders with their palms up and have them close their eyes. The test is positive if one arm drifts down or falls to the stretcher. Finally, have the patient speak and observe for any slurred speech. The true test is to ask someone to say, "You can't teach an old dog new tricks," but you don't have to use that sentence. Just listen to how they're talking and see if it's slurred or not. You can use the mnemonic FAST to remember this. That's face, arms, speech, and time. The time is for you to remember to ask about the time of onset. Either ask the patient or ask their family members. One more time, the Cincinnati Pre-Hospital Stroke Scale is facial asymmetry tested with a smile, testing pronator drift with both arms up, with palms up and eyes closed, and slurred speech. Moving on with the exam, it's smart to check the pupils of every altered patient. We'll talk more about this later, but certain toxidromes will give you certain findings with your pupils. Check for the size and reactivity of each pupil and whether you notice any nystagmus. If you're concerned about a toxic exposure, you should check the patient's skin and axilla. Check the skin to see if it's hot or cold, dry or moist. For the axilla, use a gloved hand to reach into the patient's armpits. Even if they have deodorant on, there should be at least some detectable dampness. If there isn't, it raises the possibility of an anticholinergic exposure or ingestion. The next big concern is to check for signs of infection. Do a thorough skin exam, including the buttocks area, to look for signs of infection or any concerning rashes. This is especially important in nursing home patients who may be altered from an infected decubitus ulcer. Also check for nuchal rigidity if you're thinking meningitis. Finally, be sure to listen to the lungs for any focal lung findings. Finally, also make sure to do a good abdominal and GU exam. Elderly patients are set up for serious surgical abdominal problems, and they may not be able to tell you that it hurts. One more time, let's talk about the exam. You want to do a quick neuro exam. You can use the Cincinnati Pre-Hospital Stroke Scale if you want to keep it quick. From head to toe, check the pupil size and reactivity. Check the skin for whether it's wet or dry, hot or cold. Check the axilla to see if the patient has a dry axilla. Do a good skin exam and pay attention for any rashes or petechiae. And do a good abdominal and GU exam and make sure to roll the patient to look for decubitus ulcers. Now let's talk about the differential diagnosis of altered mental status. And for each one, we'll talk about the workup for each category. We could spend the entire day talking about all the things that can make people altered, but I'm going to boil this down to the most important facts that you need to know. I'll group causes of altered mental status into a few broad categories and go from there. However, let me mention one mnemonic that will save your butt if you're really stumped on a patient with altered mental status. It's one everyone knows but probably can't remember what each letter stands for. It's A-E-I-O-U, TIPS. I'll put this in the show notes for later reference, and any good pocket emergency medicine reference should have it as well. You'll see different variations on what each letter stand for, but these are the ones that I like to have on there. So A-E-I-O-U, TIPS stands for, A is for alcohol or acidosis, E is for electrolytes, I is for insulin, as in too much insulin, or ischemia, O is for oxygen, as in hypoxia, U is for uremia, T is for toxidromes, trauma, and temperature, I is for infection, P is for psych or polypharmacy, and S is for stroke, space-occupying lesion, or subarachnoid hemorrhage. So that's a lot to remember, and I encourage you not to spend any time whatsoever memorizing that long mnemonic. If you have it written down somewhere, you can pull it out if you're really stumped. Here's how I think about altered mental status. You have five really big categories: tox, trauma, infection, neurologic, and electrolytes. If you really want a mnemonic for this, it would be TINE, like the tines on a fork, T-I-N-E. That's T for tox and trauma, I for infection, N for neurological, and E for electrolytes. I stared at these letters for a while, and that's the best mnemonic I can come up with. You may be able to figure out one that's better for yourself. So let's start with toxologic causes of altered mental status. Once again, this is a very broad topic, and you could spend an entire fellowship mastering the ins and outs of toxicology. So let's go over a few basic toxidromes, their diagnosis, and some quick points on their treatment. First, let's talk about opiates. These can be prescribed legally in the form of Vicodin, Percocet, or OxyContin, or can be brought on the street as heroin. Patients with opioid overdose will be somnolent and lethargic, and they will classically have pinpoint pupils. Their respiratory drive may be depressed, and they may be profoundly hypoxic from this respiratory depression. Opioid overdose are one of the few things for which we have a reliable and safe antidote. Naloxone, or Narcan, is an opioid antagonist that directly competes for the binding sites of opiates. Now, there are some subtle points on giving Narcan that I won't go over here. I'll save that for another episode when we'll talk about toxicology. Next, benzodiazepines are drugs that will cause somnolence and lethargy, but profound respiratory depression usually doesn't happen unless it's combined with another agent like an opioid. They usually don't have any pupillary changes. Benzos come in the form of prescription Valium and Ativan. Treatment for them is supportive. Make sure that the patient can maintain their ABCs and just watch them until they metabolize the drug. On the other side of the tox spectrum, we have uppers like cocaine, PCP, and meth. These will tend to make people hyper and agitated and will often give them large pupils. The reason for this is that they are sympathomimetics. They are similar to your body's own epinephrine, so they cause a ramping up of everything. If you think about it, the large pupils make sense, because if you need a fight or flight response, you need large pupils to get in as much light as possible so that you can see better. The treatment for uppers is supportive as well. If the patient is very agitated, give them benzos until they calm down. 2 milligrams of Ativan IV is a good starting dose, but don't be afraid to titrate rapidly upwards if you can't get the patient calmed down. In extreme cases, the patient may need to have their airway taken with RSI to ensure that they don't harm themselves or others. Now, that was a super quick review of the 3 most common toxidromes that we see in the ED. There are many more toxidromes to know, but we'll talk about those in another episode. So how do we approach a tox patient as far as the workup? Probably the most important thing is to get an EKG. Certain drugs like tricyclic antidepressants are sodium channel blockers and will cause a widened QRS, so it's important to check those. You also want to check your standard CBC and Chem-10 for any abnormalities. For any patient who is suspected of ingesting anything or is found down, an acetaminophen level must be done. Salicylate and ETOH levels should also be done to round out the tox workup, but they're not nearly as important as an acetaminophen level. The reason why is that ETOH and salicylate overdoses have distinct toxidromes, whereas acetaminophen has no specific toxidrome. The patient may just have some nausea and vomiting, or will likely be asymptomatic, so get that acetaminophen level or else you'll miss it. The one thing I would caution you to do is not to order urine drug screens carelessly. If the patient is critically ill and you don't know what's going on, by all means do it. But in a patient who is not sick, be cautious because there are a lot of drugs that cross-react with these tests and you'll get a lot of false positives. In addition, a urine drug screen doesn't prove current intoxication with the drug. It just says that you've taken it some time in the past, so it can actually muddy your diagnostic workup. So, in summary, a tox workup should include, at a minimum, a D-stick, an EKG, a CBC and Chem-10, an acetaminophen level, an ETOH level, salicylate level, and a urine drug screen if it's indicated. Next on the time mnemonic is trauma. This is a reminder that head trauma can cause altered mental status. If the patient has any history of falling either recently or remotely, get a non-contrast head CT to look for intracranial bleeding. Even if the patient has a normal neuro exam, get a non-contrast head CT if you suspect that they may have had any head trauma, or if you have no other obvious cause for their altered mental status. Also, in a patient who is found down on the street, you should get a head CT as well. One thing to look out for, if you have an older patient who has a new onset of a psychiatric complaint or altered mental status, then you really should get a head CT. I'll tell 2 quick stories here to drive home that point. I once had a 60-year-old male who was having hallucinations, according to his wife. He said he was seeing a family that was living in his backyard that didn't even exist. His neuro exam was completely normal, and I just thought he was a little bit strange. I remember telling my senior resident that I was getting a screening head CT just to make sure. It came back with a chronic subdural with 6 millimeters of midline shift. Another patient was a male in his 70s who came in complaining of suicidal ideation. He had no psych history and no recent stressors. Other than a shuffling gait, his neuro exam was stone cold normal. His head CT had a large subdural with signs of herniation. When the radiologist called me, I thought they were talking about the wrong patient. Sure enough, the patient then told me that he had fallen and hit his head 2 weeks prior before all the suicidal thoughts started. After he got admitted and got his subdural taken care of, he was no longer suicidal, which probably makes him the only patient to ever be cured of his suicidal ideation through brain surgery. So these are just two cautionary tales that if you have an older patient and they have a new onset of what appears to be a psychiatric problem, get a head CT. In general, have a low threshold to get a head CT in patients with altered mental status, especially if you don't have another obvious cause for their altered mental status. Infection is the next broad category to consider. This is especially true in older patients in whom a minor UTI can cause profound altered mental status. This is where your vital signs are important. Any signs of fever, hypotension, or tachycardia can be signs of an infection. However, keep in mind that older patients or those on immunosuppression or steroids may not mount a fever response to infection. An even worse sign is when someone with an infection has hypothermia. So if you're suspecting infection, you'll want to get a CBC, Chem-10, blood cultures times 2, UA, urine culture, and chest x-ray. A VBG with lactate can also be very useful in these patients to look at their acid-base status. In addition, an elevated lactate can demonstrate severe sepsis, which requires much more aggressive management. In addition to the labs I just mentioned, keep in mind other less obvious sources of infection. Make sure to do a thorough skin exam and look for decubitus ulcers or soft tissue infections. If there is abdominal pain or tenderness, consider the possibility of an intra-abdominal abscess. If the patient has a headache or continues to be altered and you still can't find a reason, then you should perform an LP to look for meningitis. If the patient is really sick, get broad-spectrum antibiotics on board ASAP. Even in the case of meningitis, you have a few hours to get your cultures before they will be affected by the antibiotics, so get the antibiotics on board early. Unless the patient is allergic, Zosyn and vancomycin will give you good broad-spectrum coverage. For completeness' sake, the generic name for Zosyn is piperacillin tazobactam. Zosyn is dosed at 3.375 or 4.5 grams IV, and vancomycin is dosed at 15 to 20 milligrams per kilogram IV. A usual dose of vancomycin is 1 gram IV, but some guidelines suggest 2 grams as an initial dose to reach therapeutic levels quicker. In a lot of areas, ceftriaxone has better coverage for urinary pathogens, and it's also good for adult meningitis when combined with vancomycin. Ceftriaxone is dosed at 1 gram IV, or 2 grams IV if you're concerned for meningitis. Neurologic is the next category to consider with altered mental status. There are many disorders to consider here, but the major considerations are seizures, stroke, and intracranial mass or hemorrhage. Seizures reliably cause a postictal state where the patient will be altered for a period of time before they wake up. Usually these patients are somnolent but intermittently agitated, but they should be able to move all extremities. You should see their mental status improve over time. If it doesn't, then you should consider other causes besides a seizure disorder, or consider that this is an ongoing seizure called status epilepticus. Just make sure that a D-stick is okay to make sure that this wasn't a diabetic seizure. If the patient has a known seizure disorder and you're sure they didn't hit their head, you can support their airway and wait for them to wake up and find out what may have caused the seizure. Often these are missed doses of medications, so ask them about their medication compliance. This is a situation where you should look for a medical alert bracelet to alert you to their condition, and it also may have what medications they're taking. You should suspect a stroke if the patient has a focal neurological deficit or has a positive Cincinnati pre-hospital stroke scale. After you've done a quick neuro exam and checked the D-stick, get these patients to the CT scanner ASAP. Except for managing the patient's ABCs, don't let anything delay getting the patient to the CT scanner. If your hospital has a stroke protocol, then you should activate it to ensure top priority for the CT scanner and to get the scan read by the radiologist ASAP. If you're going to give TPA for an ischemic stroke, it needs to be done within 3 hours of symptom onset, and they need to have a non-contrast head CT with no signs of intracranial hemorrhage before they get TPA. I'm going to save talking about stroke for another podcast, but the thing to know is that there are many contraindications to TPA that I'm not going to go over here. In fact, you shouldn't bother to memorize them, because if you're going to consider giving TPA, then you need to look at the entire list of contraindications and go through each one to make sure the patient doesn't have any. There are newly published criteria that allow TPA to be given up to 4.5 hours after symptom onset, but you have to make sure that the patient meets the specific eligibility criteria for the extended time window. Now, I'll let you know that TPA for stroke is not without controversy. I'm not going to wade into that debate here. Just realize that there are many detractors when it comes to TPA and stroke because it can cause serious intracranial bleeds that can be devastating. However, if the patient has no contraindications and is within the time window, the textbook answer is to give tPA. Intracranial hemorrhage and mass are two other major neurologic causes of altered mental status. Most of the time, they will be found on the head CT that is obtained during the workup. Just realize that anything that takes up space in the head can cause compression that can cause altered mental status. Electrolytes are the last broad category of all things that cause altered mental status. If you think of the various components of a Chem-10, if just about any one of those electrolytes are abnormal, then this can cause altered mental status. First and foremost, a low glucose is something that needs to be addressed right away with a D-stick before you get that chem panel. A very high glucose can signal DKA or HHS. As far as the rest of the electrolyte panel, if your sodium or potassium are either high or low, this can cause altered mental status. A very high BUN and or creatinine can suggest profound dehydration and or renal failure or uremia. A low bicarb can suggest an acidosis. A high calcium can also cause altered mental status as well. Let's talk about a few situations where you'll have to intervene immediately on electrolytes. If the D-stick is below 80, give an AMPA D50 and monitor the patient's response. If for some reason you can't get a D-stick quickly because the machine is broken, give an AMPA D50 if the patient is altered. Even if the patient's blood sugar is sky high, you won't cause any harm by giving a little extra glucose, but not giving D50 quickly to someone who is hypoglycemic is very harmful. Keep in mind that your brain needs two things to operate, glucose and oxygen, so make sure to give that D50 quickly. If the patient has hyponatremia, don't do anything except water restrict them unless their sodium is below 120 and they're having seizures. In that case, you'll want to give 3% hypertonic saline to correct the sodium more quickly. There are many published dosing regimens out there, but the most common one I've seen is 2 to 3 cc's per kilogram in intermittent boluses until the seizures stop. So for the 70 kilogram patient, a good dose to start with is 150 cc's over 10 minutes. If the patient is profoundly hyponatremic but not seizing, they may need a slow drip of hypertonic saline. If you correct their sodium too fast, you can cause central pontine myelinolysis and permanent brain damage. So make sure to do this right and look it up before you give someone hypertonic saline who's not seizing, because it's not something that we do a lot and we can cause harm. If the patient has severe hyperkalemia, you'll need to treat them quickly as well. If you're having EKG changes such as peak T waves and or a widened QRS, then they need 1 amp of calcium gluconate IV immediately to make sure that they don't go into a fatal arrhythmia. Calcium doesn't change the serum potassium level, but it does stabilize the cardiac membranes to prevent arrhythmias. Other treatments for hyperkalemia include insulin and glucose, furosemide, and albuterol, with dialysis being the ultimate treatment. Once again, hyperkalemia is a whole podcast unto itself. For now, just know to give calcium if the patient has EKG changes. So let's sum this up and talk about the large general workup for altered mental status. Not every patient with an altered mental status needs everything in this workup, so you can subtract components of this workup based on the clinical situation. However, if you're dealing with a patient who is found down on the street and is still altered, I would consider getting just about everything on this workup. First, get a D-stick. Next, get an EKG. Let's talk about the labs for altered mental status. You'll want to get a CBC, Chem-10, UA and urine cultures, blood cultures times 2, VBG with lactate, urine drug screen, a serum acetaminophen level, because they may be asymptomatic, a serum salicylate level, a serum ETOH level, and a lumbar puncture if you're suspecting meningitis. As far as your imaging, you'll want to get a chest X-ray and a non-contrast head CT. Go over that one more time. First of all, get your D-stick, get an EKG. As far as your labs, get a CBC, Chem-10, UA and urine cultures, blood cultures times 2, VBG with lactate, urine drug screen, a serum acetaminophen level, serum salicylate level, serum ETOH level, and get an LP if you think they have meningitis. As far as imaging, get a chest X-ray and a non-contrast head CT. So that's all I have for now for altered mental status. Here are the big final take-home points. Number 1, all patients with altered mental status are hypoglycemic until proven otherwise. Number 2, consider tox, trauma, infection, neurologic, and electrolytes as the major causes of altered mental status. TINE, T-I-N-E, is the mnemonic that I use. A-E-I-O-U TIPS is useful as well. Number 3, have a low threshold to get a non-contrast head CT in patients with altered mental status. And lastly, number four, get a good neuro exam on all of these patients. Use the Cincinnati Pre-Hospital Stroke Scale if you need to do it quickly. The mnemonic is FAST, and it stands for facial droop, arm strength, speech, and time of onset. That's it for this podcast. Now for a few housekeeping items. First, thank you to everyone who has filled out the EM Basic survey. The results thus far have been posted on embasic.org if you're curious. If you haven't filled out a survey yet, please take a minute or two and fill it out. I would really appreciate it. I'm using the responses that I've gotten already in an abstract that I just submitted to the CORD conference in April 2012, but my data collection is ongoing, so please fill out a survey. Also, if you haven't done so yet, please leave a comment and a rating on iTunes, and it will help me out a lot. Next, I wanted to give my recommendation to a new iPhone medical app that I think is great. As always, I don't take any money from anyone. This app is called Palm EM, and it's a fantastic new emergency medicine reference. It's got a ton of great information and references at your fingertips. For example, let's say you have a patient with neutropenic fever. In two clicks, you'll have the definition of neutropenic fever, its treatment, disposition, and valuable pearls, which are all referenced with literature. The whole app is clear and concise and written for emergency medicine people, so you won't be bogged down with a lot of unnecessary information. There's also clinical decision rules and a guide to resuscitation medications, including pediatric resuscitation medications dosed by weight and cross-reference to the Braslow tape. All you have to do is put in the patient's weight, age, or Braslow tape color, and you'll get all the resuscitation medications and equipment with accurate doses. Palm EM is available in the App Store for $4.99, and it includes lifetime free updates. That's Palm EM. That's just enter PALMEM into the search box in the iTunes Store, and you'll find it. It's definitely worth the money, and I can say that I've already used it several times while on shift. I'll post a link to the app on the EM Basic webpage. Finally, I just wanted to talk about the last episode on MI and ACS. I included the bonus section on whether cardiac risk factors matter, and then I posted it online like usual. A few days later, I was catching up on old episodes of ERCast by Rob Orman that I hadn't listened to yet. I then made the discovery that ERCast did an entire episode on whether cardiac risk factors matter a long while back. Rob Orman did a much more thorough review of the topic and cited the relevant literature. So all this to say that I just wanted to let everyone know that any similarity between the two podcasts was totally unintentional. So that's all I have for now. As always, visit the blog at embasic.org or drop me a line at steve@embasic.org with any comments or suggestions. Until next time, this is Steve Carroll for the EM Basic Podcast, signing off.